No, no, I'm just, I'm just. I'm running a viral scam.
So, ready?
It's quite a craft. I understand that the house has been attacked.
Hey, Marty, how's it going? Hi, Esther, nice to meet you. I met you.
I had fantastic meetings with IRC people in Kabul just last week.
With Melissa Payson and Tara Christman. Well, yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this project on formal and informal justice systems and creating a relationship between the two, which is what I've been working on specifically and what my trip was there for. Well, obviously, actually, because of its involvement with the Malcolm Solidarity Program, they have been very interested in sort of the potential and impact of the sort of community-based governance structures. And vice versa, because you guys have had some really interesting implementation experience. Are you in New York or here in D.C.? Oh, wow. Kath, did you know Kath Campbell, who just left the projector? She's a very, very dear friend of mine. Yeah. She's a very dear friend of mine.
She wasn't too thrilled with us because we were pushing her out of
Mayfair. Oh, really?
And her feel that you sometimes in Washington people who start off as a
pop. Right. I'm sure. I've experienced both sides of that.
I'm always going to listen to Barney. I'm going to listen to him.
Huh?
I recognize you. You know Rick,
I met him a couple of years ago.
Rick, you know Alex.
Packing boxes, you guys just kind of did it with John. I was in this movie.
Sure.
Okay.
We had so many people.
Oh, so this is so Rick's letter.
Yeah.
He just handed it to me.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you sign?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a theory about that.
Do you know Thomas Johnson?
No.
AID?
Take it off.
Number two over there, he just signed up for another year.
Oh, okay.
Right, he was supposed to be here.
Right. And your region, and as a result, your region is finished.
So you mean the number two in Kabul?
Who taxed the
name? Oh, I must be back then. I guess his name is in
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think I'll find you, but
he's not that old.
No, but great. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
We're settling. Well, we're settling in.
Somebody's pointing
day
at
by day, unpacking.
Maybe they're
box.
He's pointing at you. I don't know the guy in the second row there.
That's also.
He's pointing
true.
You out to that woman sitting next to him.
In Mount Pleasant.
Okay.
Yeah, what part? Where are you with? Oh, okay.
All right, I'm gonna start.
Yeah, we love it. See you soon.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Beth DeGrasse. I'm a senior program officer in our Center for Post-Conflict Peace and Stability Operations here at the Institute. I also coordinate our Afghanistan Working Group. I have been saying for months now that our chair, to my left, Barnett Rubin, has not been able to be with us. And I'm really pleased today that he's here. I feel like we almost need an equivalent of a Where's Waldo game for Barney. Is he in London? Is he in Kabul? Is he in Paris? Is he in New York? But today he's in Washington, and he has just come from being a member of President Karzai's delegation to the London Donors Conference.
Well, he doesn't know that.
Oh, he doesn't know that. Excuse me. I'm going to let you talk about that. To my right is Alex Thier, and I'm really pleased to be able that Alex is able to be with us today. Alex has just joined the Institute, but has spent the better part of a decade off and on in Afghanistan as a senior rule of law advisor to Afghanistan's Constitutional Commission, Judicial Commission, and in various other capacities. We're very fortunate to have him here with us at the Institute. He's just come from 3 weeks on the ground there working on a special project that he also will talk about. We're going to lead off with Barney, who's going to talk about the donor conference. And we're going to turn to Alex for some ground truth about how it played out in Afghanistan and what the implementation is likely to be there. So thank you. Barney.
Okay, thanks. I think I will stand up because otherwise people on the back won't see me. Sorry, I'm just getting these documents.
I also just want to note that we have a class here from American University, and we'd like to welcome them today. Okay.
I wondered why there were so many unfamiliar names from American University on the attendance list. Thanks. Since August, I've been spending most of my time in Kabul working with the Afghan government and the UN in preparing the documents for this conference, which included first Afghanistan's Millennium Development Goals report, which was submitted at the World Summit at the UN General Assembly in September. Then, in close coordination, the Afghanistan Interim National Development Strategy and the Afghanistan Compact, which is the declaration that was adopted at the London conference last week. These three documents are very closely interrelated. That is why you will see outside today we have two documents. One is the executive summary of the Interim National Development Strategy. The other is the Afghanistan Compact itself. And in both of these, you will also see reference to Afghanistan's Millennium Development Goals. The National Development Strategy, which is several hundred pages long, this is the interim one, and there'll be a period of 2 years of consultation before its finalization, covers the Afghan government's development strategy for the next 5 years. The Afghanistan Compact provides. Oh, hi, Ed. provides for the international community's involvement in Afghanistan for the next 5 years. You will find that the extensive benchmarks and timelines that are in the annexes to the Afghanistan Compact are identical to the higher-level benchmarks in the Afghanistan National Development Strategy. That is, the two are fully aligned, and they are essentially the compact is supposed to support the National Development Strategy. These five-year programs are, in turn, meant to lay the basis for Afghanistan's Millennium Development Goals, which it intends to attain over the next 15 years. These are basic poverty reduction goals that were set for the international community at the Millennium Summit in 2000. Afghanistan could not participate at that time, so it adopted its Millennium Development Goals somewhat late. Now, let me just go back and put this in the context of the bond agreement and what's been happening in Afghanistan since September 11th. The bond agreement was an agreement among an unrepresentative group of Afghans assembled by the United Nations, because that was the best that we could do at that time, as there were no representative institutions, who combined some elements of control of force on the ground and some elements of historical legitimacy and some elements of representing the interests of neighboring states. And the bond agreement was an agreement among those Afghans, really as individuals, witnessed by the United Nations. The bond agreement imposed obligations on the interim and transitional administrations of Afghanistan, and it provided the United Nations with the mission of assisting and monitoring the Afghan government in carrying out those obligations. Those obligations, or the timelines and benchmarks, were entirely political and relatively simple. That is, they involved trying to start with an unrepresentative gathering in Bonn and successively through a series of stages increasing the political legitimacy of and representativeness of the institutions that they formed there. And those stages were, very simply, the convening of an emergency Loi Jirga 6 months after the Bonn meeting, then the drafting and adoption of a constitution 18 months after the emergency Loi Jirga, and finally what the bond agreement called the holding of free and fair elections to elect a fully representative government within 6 months after that. Now, or 2 years after the emergency Loi Jirga, technically is what it said. Of course, at that time we didn't know what form of government Afghanistan would have. As it turned out, the constitution mandated a presidential system with both a separate presidential and parliamentary elections, as well as elections to provincial and ultimately district councils. So the presidential election was held 3 months after the deadline for the elections because the donors did not deliver the money for the voter registration on time, primarily. Then the parliamentary elections were held a year later. And with the fulfillment of those conditions, the bond agreement was implemented. The bond agreement, this is a little-known fact, but it was called an agreement for setting up, I don't have the exact title in front of me, but temporary or transitional or interim measures pending the reestablishment of permanent government institutions in Afghanistan. And now those government institutions have been reestablished. So my own soundbite about the Afghanistan Compact is that the bond agreement was an agreement for reestablishing government institutions in Afghanistan. The compact is to make them work. That means that the compact differs from the bond agreement in a number of ways. First of all, I'm not quite sure what to call it. I can't say the parties to it because it's not a treaty. It has no parties. And in fact, the legal nature of this document was a subject of considerable discussion right up to the last minute. At the moment, it has the form of a joint declaration by Afghanistan and a non-existent entity, namely the international community, which is more or less embodied by the list of participants in the London conference, which is in Annex 4. That is, this is a political document. It is not a treaty or a legal document. Nonetheless, of course, when you make a political commitment like this under the co-chairmanship of President Karzai, Secretary General Kofi Annan, Secretary Blair, in the presence of Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, and many other ministers. It has a it signals a high level of commitment. It is, therefore, unlike the Bonn Agreement, which was an agreement among Afghans witnessed by the UN, this is an agreement between Afghanistan, represented by its fully representative government, that is, its government elected according to its constitution. And by the way, the delegation there included both the president, members of the cabinet, and about 10 members of the National Assembly from both houses as well, who did not formally participate in the meetings, but they sat in on them, and so they were fully informed about what was going on there. Second, although it was a declaration of commitment by both Afghanistan and the international community, and whereas the Bonn Agreement contained measures under which the UN monitored and assisted the Afghans, this agreement under Annex 3 establishes a joint monitoring and coordination body, or as I should say, coordination and monitoring body, as the Afghan government likes to put it, to coordinate and monitor both the Afghan government and the international community in its support to the Afghan government. I say the Afghan government likes to put coordination before monitoring because, in their view, coordination is what the UN is coordination is what you do to donors, and monitoring is what you do to the Afghan government. So it puts coordination and monitoring on an equal plane. And the core statement of the compact, one which was drafted and redrafted many, many times, under purpose, states, "The Afghan government hereby commits itself to realizing this shared vision of the future. The international community, in turn, commits itself to provide resources and support to realize that vision." Now, if you parse that very, if I can tell you what's not here, that was in earlier drafts. At one time, it said, instead of in turn, it said reciprocally. It's saying that there's reciprocity between these two commitments, which makes sense to me because any Afghan government that tried to carry out this vision without getting resources and support from the international community would be committing suicide. So there is reciprocity, but some of the internationals felt that that the Afghan government should commit itself to this vision because it's its vision, and then the international community will commit itself to supporting it. Well, that was acceptable. And then it now says commits itself to provide resources and support. Previous draft said the resources and support. So this now means by omitting the definite article, which of course does not exist in Persian, that the international community is not committed to providing all the resources and support needed, which is reasonable because Afghanistan also has a responsibility under this compact to mobilize its domestic resources and domestic political support for carrying out the goals in the compact. At one point, the legal department of a particularly influential government wanted to take out the second part of the sentence entirely and just said the Afghan government commits itself to realizing these views and international community will do what it can. Of course, that ultimately did not fly. But that sort of and that actually was put that legal department of that government in conflict with its own diplomatic representatives on the ground in Kabul. And in general, I should say this was a pattern in the negotiation of this compact. There was I saw on a number of occasions quite a considerable divergence between field perspectives and headquarters perspectives, in that generally I saw this in the U.S. government, in NATO, in the United Nations, in Britain, Germany, and elsewhere, Japan, in that generally speaking, the perspective of people once they're on the ground in Afghanistan is that this is a very worthwhile project, and not only that, it's feasible if we have the right mandate and the resources. And the perspective of people in the headquarters is we have to be crazy to make commitments to trying to succeed in Afghanistan because it just seems so very difficult when seen from a distance. It's an oversimplification, but that pattern repeated itself over and over again. And it was interesting to see, I should say, how a kind of community of people concerned with and committed to Afghanistan who have been through the field there has evolved across national boundaries, and they're able to work together rather well. And I would say to some extent it's that community which carried this process through on the international level. Now, so as I said, the parties are different. It's Afghan or international. The monitoring is different. It's mutual. Also, this is a much more comprehensive agreement. As I said, the bond agreement had basically three benchmarks: emergency law, Jirga, constitution, elections, which were all political. This has, depending on how you count them, 60-some benchmarks. They're divided into three pillars of activity, which are exactly the same three pillars as the pillars of the Afghan National Development Strategy. And originally they were different. We went through a process of negotiation to make them consistent with each other. Those three pillars are security, governance, which is called governance, rule of law, what is it? Governance, rule of law, and human rights, and that includes justice. And third is economic and social development. Counter-narcotics is also included, as is regional cooperation, but these are treated as cross-cutting issues that affect all three of these major pillars. Now, the reason I also asked that my article on peace-building and state-building in Afghanistan be distributed, which you'll find out there, is because that may help, may give you some idea of what is the conceptual foundation for this three-pillar framework. Essentially, if you're familiar with, at all, any of you, with literature on state-building, building a state requires capital, coercion, and legitimacy, which is to say development, security, and governance. So these three pillars of activity constitute to the three conceptual foundations of state building. And essentially, the strategic goal of the Afghanistan Compact is to move from building up institutions of government to building an effective and accountable state in Afghanistan. Or let's put it this way, a more effective and more accountable state in Afghanistan. That is, one that will be able to be a full member of the international community of states and carry out its responsibilities to its own people and to that international community. Now, that requires these various reforms in and institution-building efforts in security, governance, and development. Now, I won't go into them too much now. We can go over them in detail in the question period. I'll just note that one of the principles underlying the compact, also underlying the Afghan National Development Strategy, is the, and which you'll also find in the recent UN documents about UN reform and the Peacebuilding Commission, is the mutual interdependence of all of these. Now, what we found, of course, in working on this is that this is not a new idea that was just invented in the last couple of years or decades or centuries. In fact, this is the opening of the Afghan National Development Strategy. It starts with a quotation from an Islamic scholar from the period of the Abbasid Caliphate named Ibn Qutaybah, and he provided what is considered to be the classical formulation of what in the Middle East and South Asia is known as the Circle of Justice, or Da'iraya Adalat. And he put it, there are various formulations of it. His is the simplest. There can be no government without an army, no army without money, no money without prosperity, and no prosperity without justice and good administration. And in artistic renderings in royal gardens and so on, the circle of justice is depicted actually in the form of a circle, which has no beginning and no end, and all of whose elements are interrelated. And this idea is identical to the idea of the interdependence of these three pillars. Now, let me say a few words about some of the issues that arose. First, in security, there is, well, I see Nicole Ball back there, so I'm going to mention the issue of the fiscal sustainability of the security forces, since she worked on that on the recently published World Bank Public Finance Management Study. Theme of fiscal sustainability is one of the main principles underlying the compact, and it's proven to be quite difficult. The United States started the Afghan National Army basically to on the basis of a mandate and a mission, which was pretty much defined by the United States, and it set the salary scale and the expenses and level of equipment and so on pretty unilaterally without going through any Afghan budgetary process. The Afghan National Army is still entirely off the Afghan budget. As of next year, it is the salaries, Secretary Rumsfeld has told the Afghan government that the salaries of the Afghan National Army, which were not set by the Afghan government and are you know, much higher than other Afghan government salaries will be put on the budget. Now, of course, there are good reasons for setting the salaries high, because you get people to be loyal, you can recruit them, and so on. And generally speaking, it's a very bad thing to be poor, because it's hard to pay for things. However, Afghanistan is poor. Therefore, unless someone is going to pay for this forever, it has to develop some outsider, in which case the name Afghan National Army would turn out to be a misnomer. Afghanistan has to develop a way of sustaining this fiscally itself. Now, this came out in the negotiations over the compact in discussions over the size of the armed forces, because the security people in the Afghan government believe that they need an army of 70,000. I think many outside analysts think they may or may not, but they cannot pay for an army of 70,000 if it is structured as the U.S. has structured the ANA. That is why the benchmark says up to a ceiling of 70,000. It doesn't say up to 70,000, meaning that that is a target which, in fact, I understand is not going to be met, and the figure that is now going around is 45,000. Now, the quid pro quo for that, which is not in the compact, is that the United States is supposed to provide for the external security of Afghanistan, because this army, of course, I mean, no army Afghanistan has ever has or ever will be able to defend the country from an invasion from, you know, its much larger and more powerful neighbors. In any case, that's not the main security threat. However, the Afghans are not very confident in that, one, because the United States policy could change, but second, because so far the United States has not succeeded on delivering on President Karzai's top security priority, which is ending the safe haven for Taliban and in Pakistan. And that is becoming a more and more contentious issue between the United States and Afghanistan, and, of course, obviously between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Pakistan has not sent an ambassador to Kabul in 8 or 9 months now, and relations between the two countries are actually quite tense, despite various professions of amity and so on. And during the negotiation of this compact, of course, there were 3 suicide bombings in Kandahar in the space of a few days, which definitely colored the views of some people. Second, the question of counter-narcotics. First of all, the Afghan government has issued a new counter-narcotics policy, the National Drugs Control Strategy. And I've been very critical of counter-narcotics policies up to now, which is not that relevant, actually. But, you know, I actually think that this counter-narcotics strategy is a rather good one. It emphasizes that the immediate priorities are interdiction of traffickers and heroin processing, the creation of alternative livelihoods and illicit livelihoods for people who are now dependent on trafficking, demand reduction, only in Afghanistan, unfortunately, which has not really solved the problem, since demand reduction in the developed world would be much more important to resolving this drug problem, and the building of institutions in the provincial areas, which people do not always realize is so important to counter narcotics. But in fact, engagement in the narcotics economy is an adaptation to a high-risk environment where there is lack of security, lack of livelihoods, and lack of institutional framework such as credit, roads, and so on and so forth. So institution building is quite important. What's notable is that among the 4 priorities of the national drug control strategies, crop eradication does not figure. Now, the compact requires Afghanistan to develop eradication capacity, and I might say the occurrence of the word eradication in the compact was at the insistence primarily of the United States and, to a lesser extent, the UK, on the grounds that it would not sell back in Washington otherwise. In addition, I'll come to this in a minute, the compact has an annex on aid effectiveness and calls for instance, support for the counter-narcotics policy of Afghanistan through contributions to the Counter-Narcotics Trust Fund, which is run by the United Nations Development Program, which would then fund activities of the Afghan government in support of its own policy. Now, thus far, the United States has not been acting in support of Afghanistan's counter-narcotics policy. The United States has its own counter-narcotics policy, under which it spends more money for eradication than it did last year for alternative livelihoods. And I just saw this on the Internet. I have not verified it, but I have been told, according to this report on the Internet, that which seems fairly reliable, that the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement of the State Department is advertising to hire people to do aerial eradication of narcotics in Afghanistan, which is contrary to the Afghan government's policy. Now, that doesn't mean they've necessarily decided to do it, but the fact is the Afghan government has decided not to do it. So there is a in addition to which, Congress has required the president in its aid allocation from last year. It fenced part of the aid allocation, which is to say it released some of it for disbursement or expenditure, whichever is the proper term. Obligation, released it for obligation. And the releasing the remainder for obligation is dependent on a presidential certification. And Tom, you can correct me on that. But I think the certification is that Afghanistan is complying with U.S. counter-narcotics policies. Well, perhaps it's ambiguous. I should check that exact language. But there is now a divergence between counter-narcotics policy as seen in the U.S. Congress, at least, and counter-narcotics policy as seen in the Afghan government. It will not come as a surprise to most of you to find that different agencies of the U.S. government also appear to have different views on, you know, where the emphasis should be. Strangely enough, they all seem to favor their own mission as being particularly important. Now, that brings me to the question of aid effectiveness and pledging. First, one of the headlines from this conference was donors pledged $10.5 billion, and it was often referred to as a donor conference. I want to emphasize this was not organized as a donor conference. We had a lot of discussions leading up to this conference in Kabul, and the UK and the UN pressured the Afghan government quite a bit to insist that this not be a donor conference. And the reason for that was, they said, first, the most important thing is the political commitment and the plan. Second, there's no time. There's no time for countries to make pledges because they have their budgetary cycles, their legal obligations domestically and so on. It just will not be possible. Therefore, the invitation letter that went out said, this is a political conference, and people and governments were represented there by their political people as well as their aid people, and it was the political people who were at the opening session, not the aid people, said that this is not a pledging conference, but any countries who wish to make pledges of support will be given an opportunity to do so. Now, despite this fact, there was a lot of people did a lot of work, and I should say in particular Ambassador Newman of the United States, I believe, did quite a lot of work back in Washington and while he was there to try to assure that there would be significant commitments, and the commitments, not commitments, sorry, pledges. The pledges that came through of $10.5 billion, well, that's not quite accurate, but I'll come back to that in a minute, were far more than anyone expected. And I think pretty much were what we thought the maximum might have been if we said it was a donor conference and had done a full court press on it. Now, I say all that is not new money. That's $10.5 billion of pledges that should be available over the next 5 years. Some of it was pledged earlier because some countries are able to pledge for 3 years or even longer, and therefore they have pledges that are going out for several years. The U.S., I think technically it's not considered a pledge because of congressional considerations, but they announced that the administration would ask Congress for a supplemental of $1.1 billion this year, and then there are understandings of what they will ask for in the future, but those understandings were not counted in that $10.5 million amount. So clearly that is, we should consider that more like a minimum. Some people in the press have compared that to the total estimate of what is needed over the next 5 years, which is closer to $20 billion, and said, oh, they got less than half of what they need. But no one expected to get full pledging for 5 years at this meeting. So that's really an example of like looking for bad news where there isn't any. However, there is another problem, which is it is actually impossible to make an accurate or reasonably accurate estimate of cost. First of all, because amounts of money are not really what you want to get. The road from Kabul to Kandahar, built by the United States with some help from Japan and Saudi Arabia, cost 50% more per kilometer than the estimate in the needs assessment presented in Tokyo in 2002. Now, there are valid reasons for that, security, trying to rush it to get it done before the election and so on. But The fact is, that doesn't mean Afghanistan got 50% more aid. It still just got a road from Kabul to Kandahar, because what they're concerned about is the road, not how much, you know, came out of U.S. government's pocket. So the amount needed depends on the cost of delivery. And because what's actually needed is real investments, not money spent. And the cost of delivery depends on the mechanism of delivery. That is why Annex 2 of this compact is about aid effectiveness. In fact, in the planning leading up to the conference, when we thought it wasn't going to be a major pledging conference, and we wanted to certain governments, like the host government, wanted to find some way to try to distract the press from what they thought would not be a very good figure of pledging. They said, this conference is not about pledging, it's about aid effectiveness, making more effective use of the money that is available. And that is extremely important, and it's relevant not only to Afghanistan. Now, there are many various elements of aid effectiveness, but the most important goes back to what is the goal you are trying to accomplish. The goal you are trying to accomplish is to build an effective and accountable Afghan state. Now, of course, that presupposes a fact, which is you do not have one. Okay. So, therefore, you cannot just take the taxpayers' money and give them to an ineffective and unaccountable organization, such as the Afghan state. But what you can do is say which is the mechanism that, the World Bank has been trying to establish through the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund, a couple other trust funds that are run by UNDP, is to set up a mechanism under which donors can put their money into a trust fund, which can be released to the Afghan government to reimburse expenses for which it produces adequate documentation and which are in accord with its policy priorities. That means the Afghan government gets the experience of policy implementation, has an incentive to actually develop those methods, those techniques of transparency and accountability, which, by the way, it can also transfer from reporting to the World Bank to reporting to the National Assembly, which shows how this is not just that aid effectiveness is also an element of democratization. Because at the moment, 75% of the public expenditure in Afghanistan is not carried out by the government. It's carried out directly by donors through their contractors, NGOs, implementing agencies, UN agencies, and so on and so forth. That means it's not part of the budget which is presented to the National Assembly. Now, the Afghan government is assembling what it calls an external budget, which includes those expenditures to the extent that it can get reporting on them. There are various reasons why that's not as detailed and complete as the core budget. But nonetheless, with so many different recording procedures, different currencies, different reporting, different fiscal years and so on, it very much undermines the public accountability of public expenditure and democratization, as well as the building capacity of the Afghan government. Now, that is why the aid effectiveness annex calls, on the one hand, for the Afghan government to take more measures for transparency and accountability, and for donor governments to therefore provide more aid through channels that go through the core budget. Now, in the negotiation of this aid effectiveness, there were three governments, three of the top four bilateral donors, U.S., Japan, and Germany, that insisted on weakening this to some extent. I would say the U.S. Was the most accommodating of those three governments. Again, its field people were, and recited, you know, people, sort of obstacles back in Washington. But I would say that on the whole, while there were some difficult moments in that negotiation, it has created a positive dynamic in that certainly I have seen how at London the U.S. announced some measures which indicate that it is trying to move in that direction within the limits that it can, and the Afghan government realizes that it has to change certain things. Now, I would say there's a huge problem with corruption in the Afghan government, which by all accounts has gotten worse within the past year. I can't say too much about this, but I happen to be sitting in an office where the procurement goes through, and there seems to be a considerable increase in sole source contracts given out by ministries going outside the open bidding procurement process. And the kind of dynamic there is, if you go through the open bidding procurement process, there are huge delays. If you go to sole source contracting, then, you know, somebody's nephew or son gets the contract. So there needs to be some investment in improving the efficiency of transparent and accountable contracting, and a lot of other things. But at least this annex has focused attention on these issues. I know this is really a policy wonk type issue, but actually it is a core issue not only for the green eye shades people, but for democratization. Because I come back to again, a country which a government which does not have the oversight of paying for its own security forces, which does not have the oversight of paying for most public expenditure and most service delivery, is not going to be able to build up democratic accountability. Legislators who don't get reports about what the security forces are doing or what how public expenditure is being used are, rather than going to revert to, as we have already seen, demagogic and populist appeals rather than engaging in institutional oversight, which is supposed to be their function. So increasing aid effectiveness and making it possible to put more aid through the government structures is key to the state-building mission as a whole. I probably should stop talking now. I'll just say two words about the Afghan National Development Strategy and one other thing, which is related to it. The Afghan National Development Strategy is, first of all, this is something, again, these national development strategies are just being developed. They're mentioned in this year's UN documents again. This is functioning as what is called a poverty reduction strategy paper, which is an IMF World Bank mechanism for enabling highly indebted countries to qualify for concessional loans in return for having poverty reduction programs. This interim development strategy goes way beyond the requirements for an IPRSP. The World Bank has said that this is one of the best development strategies it has seen from any country, not just from a post-conflict country. And in terms of Afghanistan's qualification for loans, a very important side event or side effect of this conference was negotiations that took place involving the U.S., U.K., Russia, and Germany concerning Afghanistan's debt. Now, Afghanistan, overall, Afghanistan is not highly indebted unless you count the Russian claims. But Russia has insisted on the Soviet debt, which the Soviets claim was $10 billion, 70% of which is for military equipment that was provided to the communist regime. Afghanistan does not recognize that debt, and that's been a sticking point in Afghanistan's relationship, and it's also affected Afghanistan's eligibility for loans. As the London conference coincided with Russia's assumption of the leadership of the G8 for the first time, and as Britain, during its presidency of the G8, did a great deal for debt relief in Africa, messages were sent to Russia that, especially after the Georgian gas fiasco, a Ukrainian gas fiasco, followed by the Georgian gas fiasco, that it should show that it was a responsible power by solving this debt issue. And there have now been three declarations issued by the U.S., Germany, and Russia. It was supposed to be a joint declaration, but because Russia wanted to insist on its right to get contracts in Afghanistan on a par with others, which it had complained about in Iraq, the declarations were separate. But saying that they will all agree to take Afghanistan's debt to the Paris Club, which is the kind of a creditor consortium based in Paris, treat Afghanistan as a highly indebted poor country, and permit 100% write-off of the debt. Now, this is unprecedented. The maximum debt relief ever given by the Paris Club before was 96%. And in the discussions, the bilateral discussions between Afghanistan and Russia earlier, that was the maximum Russia was willing to offer. So this meant this whole process has now also acted as leverage for clearing the books on Afghanistan's past and enabling it to reestablish its creditworthiness, which will be very important for the investments in infrastructure that the country is going to need. Well, I don't have a peroration to end with. Well, let me just say, I'll say one last thing about the United States commitment. This is paradoxical. On the one hand, American commitment is absolutely essential for Afghanistan. Although many Afghans are unhappy about things the United States does in Afghanistan, as witnessed the demonstrations the last few days, nonetheless, they are also very fearful that the United States will once again abandon Afghanistan. And to them, basically abandoning Afghanistan, if I may put it rather crudely in the way people do in Afghanistan, means selling the country to Pakistan, which is what they're afraid that that the United States will do. They also are concerned, however, that the U.S. presence there, given the state of U.S.-Iran relations, could cause them considerable problems. And, of course, during my last visit, President Karzai was supposed to go to Iran for a tripartite meeting of Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan for some important economic agreements, and he received a call from Secretary of State Rice advising him not to go, and so he didn't go. So these regional tensions are potentially damaging to Afghanistan's need for regional cooperation. So for U.S. presence, which is absolutely necessary to be effective, it would be useful if we can find some way to insulate Afghanistan from some of the negative effects thereof. For instance, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is not happy about it in certain respects either. And therefore, one item which I expect to come up on the agenda in the future will be possibly a status of forces agreement about U.S. troops, which would contradict the terms of the strategic partnership, which states that U.S. forces will have freedom of action. But 5 years is a long time for forces to be there having freedom of action under self-defense. It's starting to look as like a long-term commitment, and therefore I think the Parliament is going to start demanding a status of forces agreement, which on the one hand would provide a firmer commitment by the United States than a strategic partnership, but which also could provide some reassurance that by setting the terms of U.S. presence there that it's not there for a permanent basis and that it is not there to threaten Afghanistan's neighbors. I'm sure there are many complexities of this, but that we can discuss in the future. That, of course, is not in the compact. Thank you.
Alex.
Thanks for coming out today. It's a pleasure to be sharing the dais with Barney. Almost exactly 14 years ago today, I was sitting in an audience, I think, somewhat less well-populated, at a time when it was not so easy to get people to come out to listen to talks about Afghanistan. And Barney was standing on the dais, and I was preparing to go to Afghanistan for the first time, just as the Civil War had broken out. And so not to make you feel old, Barney, but it's nice to be up here sharing the platform with you.
Even worse is that I can't remember it.
Asia Society.
Oh,
Asia
okay.
Society, yeah. And actually, Amin Tarzi, who I hadn't seen come in, was the other speaker who's in the back, so it's nice to be among old friends here. I've just spent the last few weeks in Afghanistan talking with Afghanistan's legal government, and that is the high-level officials in Kabul and officials at the provincial and local level, and also talking to what I would still call somewhat the actual government, which are a lot of the people who aren't part of the official government but who are still in a daily way making decisions for most people in Afghanistan. And we were specifically there to talk about the relationship between the formal and informal justice system, which is why we were talking to leaders in both sectors. And I came away from this trip really with two particularly stark points in my mind. The first is that the impact of the last 4 years of assistance and particularly state building has hardly been felt at the local level. If you travel outside of Kabul, a lot of what you see sadly represents or resembles what you might have seen 10 years ago as well as 4 years ago, which is a countryside which is certainly not ruled by Kabul, but is ruled by a confusing mix of people. And the reaction of people on the ground was somewhat a paraphrase of Churchill, which is that this is the worst government Afghanistan has ever seen, except for all the others. The second point that I came away with is that among local perceptions, the Afghan government is still very much seen as a client of the international community. And the implication of that is that both the international community and the Afghan government are held responsible for the perceived failures there. As I said, we were there to talk about the relationship between the formal and informal justice system, and we talked to people from about 15 different provinces. We held regional consultations bringing together non-state and state actors, and it was a fascinating mix of people who I don't think actually spend very much time talking to each other, let alone giving their views upward to Kabul and the international community. And there was a very interesting story that I think illustrates clearly some of the problems that exist. There was a very complex series of property disputes going on in eastern Afghanistan that some of the people raised to us. And it was resulting from the fact that some local commanders in Nangarhar province outside of Jalalabad, who had been appointed by the government, were, as provincial-level officials, were giving away land that was perceived to be alternately government land or community-owned land to their cronies. And this had both the local government officials as well as local notables up in arms. The government officials, because they felt that government land was being given away illegally, and the local leaders, because this was land that they felt had been communal land of theirs for centuries, and it was also being given away illegally and to people who didn't deserve it and wouldn't use it for communal purposes. Unfortunately, the commander who was responsible for this was not only appointed as an official by Kabul, but he was seen as tied to one of what we now call one of Afghanistan's regional power holders. And this was somebody who had been clearly seen as being supported by the United States in the war on terror. And the extent to which that support has ended is a question that always comes up in people's minds. But in any event, in the lines of the people at the local level, he was tied both to the United States, particularly the United States military, as well as to the government in Kabul. And these problems were problems that potentially were going to bring up violence in these communities, and they were problems that could not be resolved in the local courts because of problems of corruption and the undue influence that this commander had in the area. Nor were these problems that could be dealt with in communities for largely the same reasons, communities being the place that had traditionally dealt with these sorts of disputes. So let me just step back for a second. You know, I think one of the things that we all know, particularly from a chart that was created by Barney a couple of years ago in conjunction with CARE International, that Afghanistan, in comparison to other post-conflict countries, did not do so well in its first couple of years. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the work of Paul Collier and others at the World Bank who wrote about the breaking the conflict trap. And one of the, I think, the most interesting conclusions of this work and research was essentially that in a host of post-conflict situations, essentially after a 2 or 3 year initial burst in funding and interest of the international community, the support begins to trail off. At the same time, this is precisely the moment when capacity may ultimately begin to exist at the local level, and so the money that was being given and typically not absorbed can ultimately start to actually be absorbed and used effectively. And so these two countervailing trends tend to be quite dangerous. And I think that Afghanistan, this compact process, has been an interesting attempt, I think, to overcome that problem. And additional pledges, I think it's very positive, have been made. But money alone, I think, as Barney ably pointed out, is not the sole test of whether this challenge is in fact going to be met. And let me quote something from the ANDS, which confirms this. This is a quote from a document written by the Afghan government and made public just a few weeks ago. "The state does not yet have the capacity or resources to govern effectively." That's a fairly bold admission. "It mobilizes less domestic resources as a percentage of GDP than any other state in the world for which data are available." And it's a pretty stark portrait, and one that is made even more stark if you consider last year's Human Development Report statistics for Afghanistan. And let me just give you a couple of those. Afghanistan in that period was 173 of 178 on the Human Development Index. Afghanistan's under 5 infant mortality rate was 25.7%. I think it was the second highest in the world for countries who have statistics recorded. Maternal mortality rate, 1,600 out of 100,000 live births, which if you think about that is 1.6% times the average number of births per woman, which is 5. I mean, you have a startlingly high maternal mortality rate. It was also rated as the worst school system on earth, with a literacy rate of 28.7%, female literacy of 14.1%.
It has access to safe drinking water for only about 23% of the population, life expectancy 44.5 years, et cetera. The point of listing all of these statistics, and not to mention the percentage, oft-quoted percentage of opium compared to the rest of the gross domestic product, is 62.5% when it's compared with the licit economy. At least these are statistics from last year. They may have changed a little bit. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that Afghanistan has always been an extremely poor country. It was certainly further impoverished by the war. But expectations for where Afghanistan is going to go in this immediate term, I think, have been extremely high, and at least at the local level have been somewhat disappointed. Afghanistan, I think, particularly in Washington, has been under tremendous pressure to be a success. In fact, the headline of the London conference was Building on Success. Which, you know, certainly there are a lot of indicators of success, but in some ways one might say that a bit prejudges whether Afghanistan is in fact going to be a success. Obviously, in the face of the failures in Iraq, I think that has impressed on Afghanistan even a greater need to appear as a success to the international community. But I think that the result of these incredibly high expectations is that, again, in the countryside, they have been to a great extent disappointed. And I think that it's quite important in this regard, particularly when we talk about governance, to think about what our expectations are for governance in Afghanistan. I think that the history of governance in Afghanistan suggests something other than the model that somewhat came out of the constitutional process. In other words, a very Kabul-centric process that ultimately trickles down from above. It hasn't worked yet. Obviously, it hasn't been given sufficient time, but I think one of the reasons that it hasn't worked and one of the reasons that it's not going to work is because ultimately decision-making and legitimacy still predominantly rests at the local level in Afghanistan, and something needs to be done to account for that during this next period. So I just want to talk very briefly about three project areas that are, I think, all the subject of sort of heated discussion and analysis right now in Kabul to illustrate some of these points that I think both say something about the international effectiveness in Afghanistan as well as the potential to establish competent governance structures there. The first is the justice sector. Again, let me quote the ANDS, pervasive culture of impunity exists due to the lack of an independent judiciary and professional law enforcement. And the second quote is that due to the inaccessibility of state justice services, only an estimated 10% of legal matters are handled by state justice services. It paints a bleak picture, and I think justifiably so, because the justice sector in Afghanistan, and this is something that is particularly near and dear to me because it's the thing that I've worked most on in the last couple of years, has really been one of the most glaring failures of the international intervention in that country. It's been very closely tied with the lead nation concept, which I think has been very controversial, in part because of the failures in the justice sector. As many of you know, there were five countries and five sectors that were assigned to be lead nations, the United States for building the military, the Germans for building the police, the British for counter-narcotics, the Italians for the justice sector, and the Japanese for disarmament and disintegration. excuse the slip. Demobilization. In the justice sector, however, the Italian government has neither been particularly successful at coordinating the international community, coordinating the Afghan government, or providing a strategic vision about how to move forward in the sector. The Afghans, for their own part, have been extremely politicized and divided over the sector. But the great cost of this is that I believe there has been an enormous missed opportunity in this sector. There has been virtually no institution building in the justice sector over the last 4 years. And in fact, what has happened instead is a deep entrenchment of, I think, some very dangerous and divisive forces, which have become increasingly difficult and will be difficult to disengage. I want to highlight, particularly given our audience here, that the next few weeks in the justice sector in Afghanistan are going to be remarkably critical So for those of you who actually think about and have a voice on these issues, I want to urge that we do what we can to ensure that Afghanistan, that the Afghan government and the international community begins to take this sector very seriously. Within the next 4 weeks, approximately, the Supreme Court is to be reappointed. And frankly, and I've said it before, it's somewhat controversial, but I think that Afghanistan's Supreme Court is really possibly one of the greatest impediments to true democracy and the rule of law being established in that country. And if it continues along the lines that it has been, and I've been told after discussing this with people in the Supreme Court and in the Ministry of Justice, in the President's office in the last couple of years, that it is, last couple of weeks actually, that it is not only likely to continue, but in some sense may actually get worse. So I think it's an area for real caution and concern. And I'll say that the ANDS and the compact, I think this is one of the areas in which they were most vague as far as the benchmarks for this sector. And again, I think that that's problematic because I think that there is the potential and the need for real monitoring in the sector to ensure that there is some progress. And so it's something that I think needs closer consideration. The second is the question of the PRTs. The reason I bring up the PRTs is because, again, it's going through a sort of controversial evolution, not only in terms of the handover of to NATO, particularly in the South and the East, but also in terms of what the roles and the functions of the PRTs should be. If you've been paying attention to the PRT debate, you'll know that the roles and functions of the PRT have basically been in constant evolution since the idea first came up in 2002. Originally, the PRT was conceptualized as responding to an urgent need. That was that the international community had essentially ignored security in most of the country, and ultimately it became necessary to think about how we were going to deal with the security situation, which meant putting out small mobile teams of armed forces, both from the peacekeeping community, the International Security Assistance Forces, as well as from the coalition, to start dealing with the security question. But as soon as the roles of the PRT began to be defined, security was the last thing on their minds. It was the thing that they simply were unwilling to commit themselves to, and they have spent a lot of time sort of, I think, filling in that gap with other roles that I think have had a more questionable impact. The particular question right now that's going around in Kabul is the role of the PRTs in ensuring and supporting local governance structures. And while I think it's critical that the PRTs be seen to be supporting local governance structures that are created through cooperation of the international community and the Afghan government, I do not think that the PRTs, particularly uniformed soldiers, should be the ones who are on the front line of this process. But when you talk to military people, both in Kabul and at the local level, one of the things that they say in a helpful or trying to be helpful sort of sense is that they want to be a conduit between the local government and the Kabul government. And I'm afraid that that reflects a very deep misunderstanding of what I think the appropriate role of uniformed military soldiers is, both in terms of our own culture, and when I say that I mean sort of the international development community, but also in terms of Afghan culture. I think that what Afghans want at the governance level and at the local level from the PRTs is a guarantee of security. What they do not want are military uniforms essentially being a conduit between local officials and the Afghan government, which reinforces the very negative perception that the government is wholly owned entity of the international community and particularly of the coalition forces. It's not a way that we are going to promote the legitimacy of the Afghan government, and that legitimacy at the moment I still find is sorely lacking. The third issue is the National Solidarity Program. And I only raise this because I think that the National Solidarity Program in many ways represents sort of the best of our international intervention in Afghanistan so far. This is a program that seeks to work with communities, They help them to form local shuras or councils that are given block grants, and they are given the opportunity to do small-scale local development projects, putting in roads, putting in electricity, putting in water and irrigation projects, the types of things that Afghanistan desperately needs at the local level to help ensure its development. And this program is working with local communities, and from what I've been able to tell, talking both to people in the field who are part of this process as well as people in Kabul, is that it has been a tremendous success, not only in that it has actually helped to deliver goods to the Afghan population, but it's also having this amazing effect where Afghans at the local level are being engaged in decision-making processes, and that they are actually taking ownership over development. And so in many ways, it combines the best of both worlds, because it has been an Afghan-led process, but is strongly supported by an international community, both in terms of technical assistance and in terms of a tremendous amount of funding. The big question that comes up when you talk about the NSP, though, is sustainability. It is meant to cover 40,000 villages in Afghanistan. So far, it's entered 10,000 villages. It's tremendously expensive. It's going to take another, at best, 4 to 5 years until all of the villages in Afghanistan are covered. But what happens to all of this work and investment at the community level when the NSP moves on, first of all, to the next village, and then stops having funding? It's that type of thing that needs to be considered seriously, both in terms of the types of local-level governance structures which are going to be established going forward in the country, which are as yet undetermined, but also in terms of how the international community is going to fund sustainable practices. So a very brief conclusion is, I think, to focus on three points. First of all, the security question. It is a question that I feel that we have still not really tackled fully in Afghanistan. The benchmarks that are set out in the ANDS are very important benchmarks for Afghanistan's ultimate stability, but there are still very real and critical security problems around the country at the moment. The last few weeks, I think, in terms of suicide bombings and the demonstrations and otherwise, demonstrate that security is very precarious in Afghanistan in all parts of the country and could still spin out of control. And I think that the most important point on this issue is that I truly believe that Afghanistan has now reached a tipping point where impunity is going to be more destabilizing going forward than the cost of ending impunity. In other words, one of the reasons that the international community and the Afghan government have not tackled the question of impunity around the country thoroughly is because they feared that it would destabilize the countryside. I think that tide after the elections has now turned, and the failure to take on impunity is going to so severely delegitimize the government in the eyes of Afghans that it bodes for the potential for future conflict. The second is that Afghan-led processes are costly. It is going to require a tremendous amount of investment, and I think that is what a lot of the ANDS is about. Because things like the Civil Service Commission, civil service reform, and all of these things have had 4 years to go somewhere, and they have gone nowhere thus far. Institutions have not really been effectively tackled. It's a tremendous amount of human resources to be invested, and it also means donors being willing to step back and allow the time needed for these processes to develop so that they can, in fact, be Afghan-led. The final is real donor coordination. I think that things like the Bonn Conference and things like the London Conference have been fantastic for Afghanistan, and they are incredibly important for setting benchmarks for the future of a country. But when you look at donor coordination on the ground, it has not been implemented as a result of these sorts of meetings. And what I mean by donor coordination is that I mean real strategic coordination. When you look at the way that sectors are handled when there tend to be a multiplicity of donors, it is often a situation of donors not only ensuring that their objectives are meshed well with each other, but in fact that they don't conflict with each other. And it's still something, unfortunately, that I feel that we have to get right. I think that there has been a lot of effort to change that, But that sort of coordination really needs to happen not only at the international level, but it needs to happen at the Kabul level, and it even needs to begin starting to happen at the Bamiyan level and the Gardez level and the Maimana level. In other words, our strategic objectives as donors really need to be meshed in such a way that they support what are going to be the increasingly limited resources that go into that country. Thank you.
I want to thank Barney and Alex for parting the curtains for us and letting us look behind the scenes on both the national, international, and local level. And we would like to take your questions now. If you'd like to line up at the microphone and before you ask a question, identify yourself, we will have our panelists respond. Oh, come on. What? Yeah, well, no question.
One wants to be first.
Okay. A brave soul.
My question is for Mr. Thayer. Is that how you pronounce it?
Thayer.
Thayer. My name is Ryan Gaskin. I'm with American University. I saw that you, or I was listening, you had concerns about the PRTs and them being a destabilizing factor because it makes the government look inefficient or ineffective or illegitimate. But does Afghanistan lack the human resources to do it internally and do it themselves? And isn't a bigger risk to take the time to do the training, which makes the government look ineffective because it's not delivering services rapidly?
Sure. Go ahead.
I think that the PRTs have the potential not to only be destabilizing, but to be a very stabilizing force. The concern is really that they not be seen as too much out front, particularly on issues that aren't security-oriented. And I think that, I mean, obviously you put your finger on something that I think has been a critical element of both of what we've been saying, is that human resources are and continue to be Afghanistan's, I think, gravest deficit. The country is a tremendous place and it has a lot of things, but human resources to perform governance and security functions, unfortunately, is not one of them yet. And there has been a grave need for the PRTs. They are definitely fulfilling a need that did not, a capacity that did not exist within the Afghan government. But they also have to be careful not to displace that capacity so that it neither exists nor is perceived to exist.
Thank you.
I'm going to take two questions in a row, and please identify yourself. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I'm Julie Ide from Catholic Relief Services, and I actually have two questions, so I don't know how that will work. But the first question is for Dr. Rubin about the counter-poppy efforts. I read a policy brief just a couple weeks ago, a suggestion from academics that one way to approach the issue would be to create a subsidy for wheat production for the next 10 years and backing this up with a market board that would ensure a market for this kind of thing. Was that discussed during the London conference in any detail? And then the other question I have is for you, Mr. Thayer, about the PRT, the ongoing discussion about this role. And is there any indication that there will be a definite mandate of this role? And also on the issue of authority, is there any sort of indication that there will be a clear authority for all of the PRTs, or are we still sort of looking at this issue of ad hoc measures and different national interests at play?
Thanks, Julie. Hold those. And Masood, can we take your question?
Dr. Rubin mentioned the difference between the perception on the field of the government representation in Afghanistan and those governments that are in the West, perhaps. I wanted to see if you can expand on that, Dr. Rubin, and the perception of risks today in Afghanistan and what they are. Otherwise, are those risks as understood today outside, that perception, are such that they're in a possible magnitudes of a post-9/11 or 9/11 type or a Taliban type that would really make the international community commit themselves in a concrete manner. You know, a lot of things has happened since 9/11. So are these risks, you know, the true risk as you see them in there, perceived such that are there are of a significant amount that that commitment, as you know, in the compact or the pledges that are made, such that they would actually continue to support the perceived success that can be supported by the field people that are expressing it. Thanks.
Okay. Actually, first I want to say something about PRTs briefly. One unrecognized aspect of PRTs is that for the first time they have created provincial development budgets in Afghanistan, which never existed before. That is to say, because the Afghan government was so centralized, there were no provincial budgets. There were only budgets of different centralized line ministries, which had some expenditures in the province. Now, in each province now, or at least those were their PRTs, the PRT has some kind of development fund. Well, the Lithuanians in Ghor only have $3 million, but actually you can do quite a lot with $3 million in Ghor if you have, you know, the right development people. Now, the problem up till now has been that actually they don't know how to spend them because your average, you know, 32-year-old army captain does not really know what are the major development priorities of Kandahar. They've been consulting with the governors, but of course some governors are worth consulting with and others are not. But now all provinces have elected provincial councils. And there's going to be a National Assembly also scrutinizing expenditure. So this is actually could be an opportunity for experimenting with different models of devolution that, in Afghanistan if the PRTs are willing to share some of the responsibility for the disbursements with the locally elected authorities, and it can be done in a legal way. Now, about counter-narcotics, I saw that suggestion. It came out of the seminar about wheat. It came out of the seminar at Harvard. I think someone must have been studying all the most dysfunctional agricultural policies of Africa for the past several decades and thought, why not try it in Afghanistan since we already tried communism, Islamic fundamentalism, and monarchy. I don't know what to say. I mean, what the Afghan National Development Strategy says about the future of agriculture in Afghanistan is that, first, we need to spend money on building up infrastructure for production and marketing, not for subsidizing subsistence crops. That is water, and roads, cold storage, and so on. Second, Afghan agriculture needs to diversify. Actually, poppy is a very good model, except that it's illegal. It needs to diversify into high-value crops that can be processed locally, thereby creating off-farm employment, and then exported. I have a company that's trying to do this in the essential oils area. Other people are trying other things as well. But wheat production, I mean, Afghanistan, it's cheaper to buy wheat from Pakistan, okay? And that is not going to change. Afghanistan has advantages in horticultural production, which it has always had, and possibly in certain niche markets, and that is what it should be trying to do agriculturally. Well, of course, the subsistence sector will increase, and Afghan wheat yields can increase through the application of fertilizer and more irrigation. The compact says the only task of that PRTs are given under the compact is helping stability and security and supporting security sector reform. That's the only test that's given there. So that at least provides some kind of a framework. Now, as far as the perceptions and risks are concerned, I would say I don't perceive any lack of commitment by international actors to Afghanistan. Usually I don't like the term international community because, as I said, it denotes a non-existent entity. But when you are in Kabul, you actually feel like maybe there is such a thing, at least here, because you see it kind of operating, badly coordinated. Maybe they don't know how to accomplish their goals and so on. Mismatch between means and goals, capacities, and, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't see a problem with lack of commitment. What is the nature of the risk? I don't think it's primarily, everyone knows Afghans are not so much are not involved in global terrorism. Of course, and Al-Qaeda is still active, and apparently it can be active without having bases in Afghanistan. But if it did get bases in Afghanistan again, that would be worse. But I think more important is the demonstration effect that international actors led by the U.S. and the U.N. are actually committed to and interested in helping people in failed states, and particularly Muslim states, have better lives. That's what the compact is about, and not just exploiting them to try to pursue their strategic goals. Now, whether that is true or not, I think is still an open question, but I think that many countries see a very strong interest in demonstrating that in Afghanistan. There's a subsidiary interest, of course, in many countries who oppose the invasion of Iraq and many other policies of the United States, nonetheless want to demonstrate their cooperation with the United States in some area of importance to it, and Afghanistan is that place.
Alex?
I just want to say, if many of you have noticed in the last year or two that Barney smells of lavender, it's because of his investment strategy in Afghanistan. In response to the PRT question, I think it still is somewhat of an open one. Obviously, with the transition to NATO leading the PRTs, particularly in the South, they are working very hard on this question of mandate and the infamous national caveats. The national caveats, for those who don't know, are when the PRTs, basically manned by sort of every color in the rainbow of the international community throughout Afghanistan, each country, as it agreed to set up a PRT, came up with its own caveats about what they would do and where they would go. So the Germans in Kunduz, which was never a terribly dangerous spot to have picked a PRT to begin with, weren't allowed to spend the night outside of their compound. There have been other such iterations of this problem. As the PRTs are being increasingly taken over by NATO, and in areas where the war on terrorism, the fight against Al-Qaeda and Taliban is still very active, this obviously becomes a much more critical question, because this includes things like rules of engagement. Who can you shoot at? When should you? How far outside of your base do you go to do that? Stop drug traffickers when they come trundling by the entrance to the PRT with truckloads of opium. And so it's something that they are now trying, I think still, as far as discussions I had with people, at least in the U.S. Embassy on this last trip, there are still some quite open questions about how they are in fact going to function. And obviously this has been reflected in fears within the Afghan government about the NATO takeover of the PRTs, because they're frankly afraid, and again, what I mean by the NATO takeover of the PRTs in the southeast of the country, because they're fearful that limited rules of engagement are going to mean limited interaction with the forces that continue to destabilize or attempt to destabilize the country. And as that security threat, at least over the last 6 months, seems to spike, the suggestion that the forces stationed there are going to be less robust in dealing with this challenge is one that deeply concerns the Afghan government. That is, of course, coupled with the fact that the United States is going to be reducing its forces there, which they also see as an ominous sign.
I was wondering when someone was going to bring up that issue. I'm going to take Nicole and Ambassador Smith together.
Nicole Ball, Washington, D.C. based consultant. I want to thank both speakers for really interesting, stimulating presentations, and I want to ask Barney two questions. Barney, of course, I was very happy that fiscal stability in the security sector was right there at the top of the list. You mentioned that the ANA is now got a ceiling of 70,000 people, but really there will be 45,000. The question is, are these 45,000 total or 45,000 fighting? Because fighting forces were always going to be about 45,000, and then there were logistics and whatever else, plus the Ministry of Defense, which also always was a very much of an afterthought, I think, in terms of our strategy for doing that, developing the military part of the security sector. So what is in that 45,000? Now, you talked about the ANA, but not about the rest of the security sector. And it's quite true that ANA salaries are highly problematic.
not only because they're not sustainable, but because of the upward pressure they put on police and intelligence and everybody else. And my understanding was that in 2005, the police were treating themselves to salaries that were going to exceed ANA salaries, and so on and so forth. Now, the question is, to what extent is really the entire security sector taken into account when we talk about the sustainability or insustainability of expenditures? And to what extent is either both the Afghan government and the international actors taking this problem into account? I mean, that was a central finding of the World Bank report that you mentioned, and I'm curious to know whether any impact has been made. Thanks.
Grant Smith from Central Asia Caucasus Institute, previously with the Department of State. My question is on the counter-narcotics part. From a strictly U.S. point of view, it seems to me that our problem is not that Afghanistan is producing opium and heroin, but that the production of opium and heroin causes a problem for governance in Afghanistan, that the money from that is going to warlords, to the Taliban, to other forces, and also that it will have other pernicious effects in the country of Afghanistan. But from strictly consumption terms, the stuff that's produced there doesn't come to the United States, it goes to Europe, and you can think of the $2 billion that Afghanistan is getting from that as a transfer of resources from Europe in addition to the formal aid that Europe gives to Afghanistan. But my question has to do with the counter-narcotic strategy. I've looked at the compact and the national development strategy, but I haven't had a chance to look at the counter-narcotic strategy. In fact, when I tried to get at it, it wasn't there yet. I think I got a link to it on one of your listservs. Does the counter-narcotic strategy look not just at the overall question of production and how you deal with it in these four different areas, but at how you get it, these links between production and the warlords and the Taliban, and in other words, the pernicious effects of the production?
Okay. Well, on the ANA ceiling, my understanding, Nicole, is that it's 45,000 total. And I understand that to be the case because I know that the defense minister is not happy about it, although I haven't looked into it in great detail. The police number also, if you look at it, it's 62,000, but again, that is depicted as a ceiling up to 62,000, not as a goal in the compact. So there's no benchmark in the compact that says you have to have a 70,000 man army and a 62,000 person police force. It says that those are ceilings. Now, you're quite right about the upward pressure on salaries. Essentially, you know, when you have, I mean, the Pentagon has a different way of planning its expenditures than do most other institutions in the world. You know, its expectations about how, you know, to what extent money will be available and whether it can get what it asks for and so on. So, and those type of expectations are generally not appropriate for budgetary planning in Afghanistan. I would say that the questions have not been adequately addressed, but for the first time, there is now a document which everyone says they've adhered to that has put fiscal sustainability of these forces up front. Someone in the Afghan National Security Council told me that they were amazed to hear Rumsfeld talking about fiscal sustainability of the army in one of his discussions, which is something new. So I would say we're at the early stages of this discussion. I would also just suggest, just from my point of view, the sole issue is not about salary levels and size, but also about the structure and mandate of the forces. For instance, in the past, Afghanistan had a conscript army, and it had a largely conscript police force. It was not nearly as professional as the army that's now being built, but they could maintain it. Now, the question is, what is its mandate? And this is a long-term historical problem of Afghanistan. Basically, this territory does not produce enough resources to pay for governing it or defending it. And therefore, until such time as it does, if it ever can, given its aridity and lack of resources and so on. It will only be a stable state when outsiders either agree in a rather unstable way not to interfere in it, that's the buffer state model, or when, well, actually that's only part of the buffer state model, or they agree to provide it with external resources, which is what is going on now, and that only stabilizes it when it's done in a way that doesn't threaten others and lead them to intervene. So now the Afghan government is trying to figure out a way that they can get enough resources so that they can feel more self-sufficient. The long run, the only way they could do that would be really to develop an economy, but there's no way that Afghanistan, you know, Afghanistan is, both Iran and Pakistan are much larger, have many more resources, and so on. So ultimately, and it's in one of these documents somewhere, you know, security, maybe it's in the ANDS, I forget, you know, will have to come from agreement on a security structure with the neighbors. But we are a long way from any kind of security structure in the area. So this instability of the sustainability of the Afghan security forces is actually a symptom of a much deeper national and regional problem that we do not have a long-term solution for. On counter-narcotics, first I just want to note that Alex mentioned some figures. The I won't go into this here, but the macroeconomic analysis of both the narcotics economy in Afghanistan and of the impact of counter-narcotics has been quite ignored. Interestingly enough, GDP has been defined formally in Afghanistan as GDP except for drugs. That is all the GDP except for the largest sector. However, the IMF has a draft paper, which is circulating for comment, in which it tries to use available figures to actually estimate the macroeconomic, both real and monetary impact of narcotics, and to develop a simulation model through which you can estimate the impact of various types of counter-narcotics policies on effective demand, incomes, balance of trade, and so on, which is a very useful tool. And of course, one of the aspects of the compact and the ANDS is that they integrate counter-narcotics across the pillars. The goal is not just in other words, counter-narcotics is not considered, as most drug people consider it, as just part of drug policy, which is to lower drug consumption. And I think, as Ambassador Smith rightly said, the goal of we can't solve the problems of drug consumption in the developed world in Afghanistan. I mean, if they can't solve it, if Europe and the United States cannot solve this problem with all their resources, why would we say, okay, as a second-best solution, let's have Afghanistan solve it? The problem is to deal, quite rightly, with the governance and corruption and terrorism problems that this causes for Afghanistan. But that means you have to do it in a way which is consistent with stability, security, and so on in Afghanistan. The ANDS devotes some discussion to this. I won't go into it now. Now, the counter-narcotics policy itself does talk about eliminating narcotics-related corruption in the government as an important component of law enforcement, which is part of the counter-narcotics policy. However, the policy is mainstreamed across other policy areas. And for instance, in the public administration benchmarks of the compact, there are provisions for the establishment of transparent vetting mechanisms for both senior appointments and for civil service appointments, which would include vetting for involvement in narcotics. Of course, one may be somewhat skeptical as to how easy it will be. It won't be easy to institute these. There will be a lot of resistance to it and so on. But it's an example of how it is mainstreamed across the various components of the compact. I should note it's also mainstreamed into the economic strategy because within the overall economic strategy, first, the target is defined as a level of growth sufficient to raise people's standard of living and compensate for any contraction caused by counter-narcotics. And also, it's supposed to be pro-poor growth, which means it is necessary to economically empower the poor, protect their rights to own assets, in particular land, which Alex talked about, which is a huge problem, and protecting land rights. There are benchmarks for the protection of land rights in the compact as well, which is necessary for the poor to be able to borrow money and to have security in any assets in which they invest. So I would say the impact of counter-narcotics is not only in corruption of governance, but also on market distortions, because it helps reinforce non-market power of economic actors, so that the major drug traffickers in many regions also control access to credit, access to land, access to foreigners, access to the aid system in many cases as well. Counter-narcotics actually is, as you rightly say, essentially a governance and security problem as well as a development one.
I just want to add one word about security sector sustainability because of the incredible commitment and progress that's been made with the Afghan National Army. I want to remind people, if you go to State Department and some military offices, you might see a candy bar sitting on desks. And that candy bar, it's a bar of chocolate, and it says Afghan National Army. And this was actually produced by some high-level diplomats in Kabul in 2003 as a sort of joke that they had to go around selling candy bars in order to raise money for the Afghan National Army. And that is the sort of success story of U.S. commitment to standing up an institution and funding it over time. If you think about that in terms of what's happened over the last couple of years with the standing up of the National Police Force, there's really a grave contrast because the National Police Force has not enjoyed nearly the sort of progress that the National Army has. And at the moment, budgetarily, the Ministry of Interior is not even able to support what has been done. And that is, again, a fairly minimal accomplishment. If they were to actually meet some of the goals that are on paper for the National Police Force, at the moment, from a budgetary perspective, I believe that it's still wholly unsustainable. And if there is going to be a transition of governance in Afghanistan from one where the military is primarily an inward-focused entity to one where actually policing is the primary means by which law is enforced in the country, then we're going to have to shift some of that balance. But as far as I can tell, it's really not on the cards at the moment.
I'm going to have to end the meeting at noon. I'd ask those that are still waiting to ask questions to come up front and ask those when it's over. Again, I want to thank Barney. We've waited so long. But it was well worth the wait. I'm sure that the AU students felt like they got a PhD-level seminar here, and indeed they did. And Alex is just also has abundant knowledge and insights on the region. Thank you all for coming, and stay tuned for our next meeting. Thank you.
Hi, Vince. How are you
doing?
Fine, thanks. Hi.
Sorry. You actually preempted the question I was going to ask you,
okay.
Which is that ANA and fiscal sustainability, as well as the AMP.
Oh, you were.
Well, fiscal sustainability. It seems like on one hand, now money is being flowing on a much larger level.
Well, they're first reforming the MOI. He's trying to, but they don't know how it's going to work. Hi.
Thank you.
Well, here you go. You just read this, and it'll tell you. Of course, we don't know, but this is the plan. It's outside.
Yeah. Okay, wait a minute. So we're on our list, correct?
Okay. No, I'm at the center on the
Are you looking at the Iraq
Not directly.
So you're replacing Beriak?
Okay.
Hello? Yes? Hi, how are you? I can come later today, but not tomorrow, because I'll be. Look, why don't we just try for next time I'm in Washington? It sounds like today's too difficult. I won't be here tomorrow.
But I will also talk. Hi.
No, I have to leave before that. So, but I'll be here on the 23rd. February
20th.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I have a meeting at 3:30.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, you know, early.
This is true. And a lot of the same actors in the neighborhood are.
Well, how about before that?
Critical to career as well.
Okay, that's good. 2 o'clock on the 23rd. Okay.
Well, you know, we're doing a lot on Korea.
Yeah, I sent it to you.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I understand. All right, we'll keep you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay.
Hi, best to Chris.
Sorry, hi.
Oh, you do? Yeah. I was with their program in the late 90s.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I saw Doug this week. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, you are?
Doug is economic counselor in the embassy right now. Oh, at the dinner party where we were talking about my project.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in the school, I'm sure you see your attestation.
Oh, good.
We have a really good strong
have to change the name of this appointment.
This is what we're bringing forward to this Washington Consortium.
Okay. Yeah.
But I would say that you should contact us. I did not bring a card in. But ask outside, really, and get a card and just contact us. I'm not working Iraq directly for doing Afghanistan. I shouldn't say that. We all do Iraq. but there are certain, you know, very specific individuals that are doing Iraq. So.
Well, I wouldn't call it notes. I'm just, you know.
No, but I thought there was a machine.
Yeah, it was.
You say you're similar. All of our, all of the whole institute works on it. Every single part of the institute is involved.
I mean, in Paris. Who's the ambassador?
Well, you know what? I would encourage you just look at our website and look at our vacancies. Yeah. If you go outside, there should be someone at the desk out there just to get a sample of my car. Yeah. Okay. Good luck. Yes. 15. Yeah. Hey.
Yes. I think 15. someone has mentioned it to me.
I'm going to be pretty busy next week, but it's flexible, so we'll figure out something.
Yeah, let's do that. Next week will be really good.
Okay, sure.
Great.
Right.
I think Jawad mentioned it to me too, and I saw him.
I'll
just give you my email. I'm going to say I'm running the cards.
Sure.
I'm sort of on the other side now.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, thanks.
Okay.
Very good.
Thank you.
Sure. Let's start with email.
Okay. I'll do that. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Hi, how are you?
Good to see you.
Hi. What are you doing back now? Are
well,
you done?
I was working in London last week, and I'm trying to get our supplemental request and some other stuff.
Yeah.
And we're heading back. So, listen, quick question, if I could.
Yeah.
There's noise beginning in the AIOG here about benchmarking.
What's the AIOG?
Operations.
Oh, okay.
The ambassador panel.
Yeah.
Tony here in Russia. I'm going back to the investor saying my understanding from the discussions we were all having before Christmas is at this point the strategy is to
Yeah, that's an interesting thing.
And you need to then prioritize, which is
right.
You know,
it's good to see you again every once in a while. I mentioned that, you know, when the Titans ruled in INR and Eliza Manifold kept the folks in the other agencies in line.
Safe to say that constant prioritizing is going to happen because of now and ADF.
I didn't know anything. What's
happening? They're not going to have an ADF in April. It's going to be, but I think they're conference style. They're, it might happen in May.
Okay.
It'll be, I mean, by then, whatever they do will be very still, only very preliminary. But that's the idea.
Quite a bit of cooperation.
So there,
and the whole new DNI structure on top of this has brought a whole lot of.
Oh, yeah, I think that's understood. Yeah.
But
the lead nation is dead.
Lane was the one where this sort of pushed us for how the
Well, that's what I'm sure that's what the UN is working on back in Kabul now. Except that, of course, with the new SRSG, I just found four Tom Koenigs for viruses. And I'm here, so you know, two.
Hi, I'm Alex.
Oh, you're Bill Gisardi. Oh, hi. Nice to meet you. Who are you working with now?
Just came back from Afghanistan. I was working for the elections.
Oh,
I'm going to bring you up to the PRT thing because there's some late developments.
Hi, this is Bill.
I'm the deputy director of Pakistan.
Oh,
I'm
Pending on my desk, yeah.
Oh, I hope you're doing it for her. Right. She's just great.
I forgot. I traveled since then. I forgot about
that.
Okay, now. Yeah, I'm right. I just found four viruses on my computer. So.
Yeah, it was a great trip, actually.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out. I want to delete them before anything else.
Grant is going to join us.
Good. Good.
All right.
Good. Thank you.
I saw the letters out here.
Yeah, I'll be over in a few months.
Yep. That is the hill.
How long
is
the hill?
It's sort of the name of the roll call. Yeah. Every congressional office, and I got to them, and I ran yesterday.
Oh, that's what that is. I didn't read it. That's the shorter version.
Okay.
The program office is responsible for the entire
budget. So you're doing this.
Yeah.
And then we got the letter from the other coordination here, which is close to so I mean, it's kind of worse for us.
All right. Let me get this started. Okay. That's good. Well, it's something to work with, you know. Use it as an entree.
Do you have a schedule?
Well, I'm hoping to talk to Alonzo.
Okay. You know where my code is?
I went over originally.
When you came in, where did you?
I think Illy took it.
Oh, I was in the closet.
So I'm back in April with Paul Dobriansky, working on ICT overlapping women's issues and developing for the Future Training College program.
Right.
I was
looking
back
at it
before.
Okay. Well, then you got this stuff with the plane, too. Well, my main point is that under our program office, we have SO.
Barbara, are we still there?
Oh, yeah. But we just hired a new janitor.
Good to meet you.
I don't think that's exactly what.
Okay, good to see you either here or there, right?
Thanks, Tom.
Great
show.
Thank you.
That was meant to be a continuation of the infinitive rather than the curve.
Well, you're in the budget.
Good to see you again.
You were in the budget, actually. So, oh, good. Okay. You have this.
Is this our letter?
It's Tom.
Yeah, this is our letter. Okay, I haven't seen it printed out.
Is this available electronically?
I can send it to you.
All right. Let's
okay.
Yeah.
I'll send it to Tom. Hey, we should give
her a
Jessica.
How long
will
you
wrap
for?
Do you know Jessica?
I'm leaving after lunch. I gave her one.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I mean, if I write, I mean, Washington.
Jennifer.
Yeah.
Jennifer.
So I'll be in the U.S. for a little while.
Okay. So hopefully.
catch up with you before next trip, then I'll probably get back in April.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll hitch a ride with you.
For whom?
I'll hitch a ride with you.
Oh,
you're going.
She's one I worked with initially back in 2004.
Oh, okay.
Trying to look at some more glass and do some development issues with the whole ICT development.
Okay.
That's right.
Hi.
Hi, Greg.
Hi.
Oh, you're right.
Okay.
Yeah.
You go.
Okay. Greg's the man.
Everything worked out for
yeah.
Like sweeps.
Yeah, no, I'm here for
okay.
Story.
Okay.
What?
Yeah, what happened was, for that reason.
Something fell into crack during the trip.
It's funny because it was actually the one that was falling on the crack.
Okay.
Good to
see
you again.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
See you, Barney.
All right, Barney, thanks.
Where
does
my phone?
It's in the closet around the corner, probably. To the right.
So what do we have here? This is
this is a letter that...
This is a letter that...
Oh, he's an interesting character.
I
mean, he's got a very long, lengthy history of Afghanistan, but I happen to deal with him very specifically on some telecom stuff.
Huh.
Yeah, but I saw him over at in Marty Hoffman's office, must have been in December, and we were just by chance overlapping in a meeting, and we were talking about respective time in Afghanistan. And he happened to bring up, we were talking about our time up in the Panjshir Valley, and I said, do you put any chance?